You are listening to the Gay Florida Man Podcast. This podcast is hosted by retired corrections officer Mark DeWolf, who will discuss various topics prevalent to corrections, gay culture, arts and entertainment, as well as current events. Listeners need to be advised that this podcast will discuss situations involving extreme violence, substance abuse, sexual assault, and murder. Details of actual events have been modified so as to protect the privacy of involved parties.
Welcome back to the Gay Florida Man. This is episode 34, and today's subject is a conversation with special effects artist Cesar DeCall Jr. Cesar is not just a person that works in special effects. He's a very close friend. I've known him for over 20 years. The guy is intense. He takes his work very serious. He's the guy that creates monsters. He brings them to life, whether it be actually physical monsters, practical effects, or if it's computer-generated CGI. Cesar has done it all. He's worn all hats when it comes to the special effects industry. And it's a great conversation. A few times we kind of go down some different rabbit holes. We're very close in age. I got to tell you, I love the guy. I love his wife. I love his kids. I've watched his kids grow up. So a lot of the stories today that we're going to talk about are very personal, and things get rather serious at certain points. I can't say too much because I don't want to give away too much of the interview, but I will just say he's more than just somebody I'm interviewing. He's a friend, and I think that you're going to pick up on that as you hear our conversation. If you don't already do so, please make sure you're following us on social media. The Gay Florida Man Podcast is on Instagram, it is on Twitter, and it is on Facebook. In the interview, we talk about Cesar and his sculpting and his work in the industry, in the film industry, and he does have a channel on YouTube, and that is Cesar DeCall Jr. You can look that up, and it's Cesar DeCall Jr. at Cesar DeCall Jr. 9016. That's on YouTube. So you can actually see how he makes monsters come to life. Amazing stuff. I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving, and I hope everybody has a great Christmas. I want to send out the message and give thanks for all of my followers that you listen to us every week as we talk about different things regarding prison life, film industry, and gay culture. We're about to enter into another year, and I hope you'll continue to follow us and support us and listen to us on the various podcast platforms. With that being said, let's talk with Cesar. So joining us is a friend of mine that I've known for a long time, and we're going to talk about way back in the beginning when we first met. But at some point in the late 90s into the early 2000s, I had an interest in getting into the film business. And through a mutual friend, I was introduced to Cesar DeCall. It was an amazing introduction because we later became really good friends to this day. Welcome to the podcast, Cesar.
Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate that. It's very kind of you. It's my pleasure, believe me.
We have a lot to talk about in the next hour.
My goodness, don't we?
We sure do.
There's a lot of history for sure.
There's not a lot of baggage. A lot of times people say, oh, well, there's a lot of history, but there's also a lot of baggage. But with you and I, we've gotten along really well.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. You're not a friend, you're like a brother.
There's very few people in this world that I call brothers, a brother from another mother. And you're definitely one of those people. It was pretty obvious right from the get-go that you and I were of similar mind and spirit, that we would be getting along famously, and we did.
Yeah, we did. So going back to the first time that we met, it was at a restaurant called Tucci's, an Italian restaurant, and a mutual friend who was encouraging me to pursue this book about Friday the 13th. I really wanted to do this book and kind of like go into the history of how the film was written and all the actors and behind the scenes stories. This mutual friend of ours had brought us together because you had already been working in the industry and knew a lot of the people that were involved with the Friday the 13th franchise.
Right. So yeah, that was an interesting period in my life where, as you had mentioned, I had started my career out in makeup effects and I'd moved down to Salt Lake City, of all places, to kind of get away from the industry and not really be involved in film, but involved in video games. I had gone back to college to learn about computer animation, accepted a position at a video game company in Salt Lake City. In fact, I had made a point that I had told my wife, yeah, no, we're done. You know, it's a long story, but in short, there had been a writer's strike about a year and a half earlier from that, a pretty rough period. That led me to Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City kind of led me to some acting classes just as a way of having fun. And that led me to our mutual friend. That mutual friend mentioned that, yeah, you were working on this Friday the 13th book. I mentioned that I knew some of the players. I think namely the one person that was the most interest at that moment was Tom Savini. I had reached out to my mentor, Dick Smith. He put me in touch with Tom. I gave him a call. I mentioned about your book. And as you say, kind of the rest of that is history. But us meeting that day, it's amazing that you remember the name of the restaurant, because I would not remember the name of the restaurant whatsoever. But I do remember your enthusiasm. And it was your enthusiasm for the genre, for makeup effects, that I found really refreshing. And later, you know, came to learn about, not only did your interest in that, you know, in that book, but that you had also put on a whole show with a bunch of effects people and whatnot. And I wasn't aware of that. That was something that came later. It was an interesting period of time. And I think we met at a good time where I think you helped me as much out of, you know, somewhat of a funk that I was in terms of, oh my God, did I make the right decision to come to Salt Lake City to work for video games? You know, it gave me a bit of escapism.
You are very articulate with your words. You use the word enthusiasm. My therapist uses the word psychosis. But I appreciate it regardless, Cesar.
Well, look, don't get me wrong, Mark. I mean, at the end of the day, like, it's something that is pretty consistent, I think, in general for anybody that likes these types of things, that the horror genre tends to bring some labels. An interesting social point of view of that's happening recently on Stranger Things, that character Eddie, that everybody is like, oh my God, he's so great, and how great that period was. And let me tell you, I was Eddie. And to be that guy back then was not cool. You were not socially accepted. It was, you were always labeled, you know, the devil worshiper and bad.
Sure.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you? Like, why do you like this stuff? Like, there's something wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cesar, can I backtrack? Let me ask you this, because we're talking about the industry and we're talking about special effects. You had brought up Dick Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Before we met, what got you into the industry? What was your, we're talking now about, like, you've always loved this genre, the horror, the special effects and stuff. So how did you get into the industry? Because I think that's something that people that are listening to this podcast would want to know. Where was it that you finally said, hey, I want to be part of this. I want to create.
You know, 2020 hindsight, I'm in my 50s now. When I reflect back, and the circle of friends, everybody that I know that works in this industry and has a measure of success, we're all creature children. I think all of us were socially awkward. We were somewhat misfits.
Absolutely.
Didn't necessarily fit within the normal cliques of society and whatnot. We lived within our imaginations inside of our heads. To me, this is going to get deep. But to me, I do think that there is a level of escapism from that makeup effects provides. When you put a mask on and you cover your face, you're no longer you. You're something else. And there's a freedom that comes from that. And there's a control that you gain over yourself and over your life and how people perceive you. Because for some reason, as soon as you put a mask on, everybody thinks you're cool.
I feel exactly the same way you do. And I always felt that growing up, is you put on the mask and you become a creature. It is that escapism that you're talking about. I don't know what the problem was with the cops and the girl down the street when I was looking in her window. I tried to argue that to them, and they just looked at the other cop and was like, there's something seriously wrong with this fucking guy. He'll never be with us. He might end up working in a prison or be incarcerated at one.
And so they were true. And by the way, that's why I love you.
And that is a true story. You know that, right? That I went down the street, and this would have been freshman year of high school. I dressed up as Jason. I knocked on the back door, and she wasn't in there. And I went up on the deck, and I looked in the back window, and she was on the phone. And she turned around, and she looked, and she started screaming hysterically. And I was with my buddy Chris, and I pulled my head out of view. And I said, God damn, man, she's really scared. And I took off the hockey mask and I told him, here, put it on so you can look.
Yeah.
So he puts it on and he looks in and all you can hear is, ah! And then he pulls back. He goes, hey, man, she looks really fucking scared. Maybe we better tell her. You're a fucking pussy. Give me the mask. I look in there one more time and then I hold up the machete like, you're next, bitch. And she starts screaming again and I was laughing and I'm like, all right, let's go. We've done our job here.
Oh my God, Mark.
Yeah.
I've never heard this story. Are you kidding me?
No, I swear to God. And so what happened was like 40 minutes later, like Chris kind of like had a bad feeling about it. He's like, I got to go. I'm going home. I'm like, oh, whatever. So I go home and I'm down in the basement watching like the Marx Brothers, like midnight movie or marathon. And my parents were out to dinner and all of a sudden there's a pounding at the fucking door. And I'm in the basement and before I can go upstairs, I hear this male voice screaming, Mark, get your ass up here. And it's her dad. Her dad was out to dinner for New Year's and she called her dad terrified. So he came home from dinner and he knew it was me because I was that misfit of the neighborhood. So he marched up and came right in the fucking house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, man. That's incredible, man.
So he told me, he's like, when your parents get home, you have them call me right away. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, oh shit. Of course, you know, I'm like starting out my criminal career because he says that they had the police down there with their guns drawn. You know, I think he had like one too many rum and cokes, but anyways, he left. My dad comes home and he's got guests.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dad, can I talk to you? And he's like, you know, you can see the concern on my face. He's like, what did you do? And I'm like, I dressed up as Jace and I went down to Kathy's house. This is what I did. And Mr. Bishop paid me a visit and he's not happy. And my dad was so irritated, Cesar. He was so pissed. He didn't even answer me. Like he was just disgusted and he just turned and he walked away. And I'm like, well, what is he going to do? And so, you know, New Year's happens. They celebrate. They do their thing with the cocktails and stuff. And I'm standing in the front room of the house with the lights out watching. And I swear to God, I could hear the music from The Wizard of Oz with the witch, you know, with Mrs. Gulch. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. And here he comes. He's walking up the sidewalk. He's marching up the sidewalk. I'm like, oh, fuck, he really is coming back. Like, this guy's serious. And so he comes up and he knocks at the door. And I'll never forget. My dad answers the door. He's right there and he says, Monty, because my dad's name is Montague. He goes, Monty, we got a problem. And my dad's like, well, you know, come on in, Steve, let's talk. And we sat down, him and me and my mom and my dad. And so he starts going on about how I've done this before. And, you know, he's tired of this and he's going to go down the next day to the police department and press charges for criminal trespass. And I'm like, oh, shit. Like, I'm scared shitless. And I look at my dad like, okay, my dad's going to have something like full of wisdom to talk to this guy to ease him down. And he says, okay, well, Steve, if that's what you feel like has to be done. And I'm like, what? Fuck, you're not going to talk him out of it? I didn't say that. I could feel my eyes watering and I was fucking scared to death that I was going to go to prison for dressing up as Jason. The next day, she ends up calling me saying she knew it was me. She does not know why she got so scared. And the whole thing went away. Yeah, that was.
Wow.
But I can relate. You know, when you put on that mask and, you know, you become that character, there is definitely a level of escape. So I'm sorry I digress.
No. Yeah. That's a great story. And I'm surprised I've never heard that story before. I thought I knew everything about you.
My mom loves that story.
That's a great, no, it's fantastic. And, you know, so it kind of reminds me about, you know, Halloween a couple of years ago, pre all this COVID stuff, you know, pandemic and whatnot, where we used to be able to, you know, get together and, you know, for social events and all that jazz. I dressed up as Michael Myers and we went out. They had a Halloween contest at this event. And there was somebody walking around handing away these tickets, like, you know, ooh, I liked your costume. I get one of these tickets, but when we get up on stage, there's about 10 of us that they've selected. You know, there's a person kind of interviewing. So are you dressed up as, right? And they come to me and I'm wearing Michael Myers. I can't talk. I'm Michael Myers. I can't, you know, I can't. They're asking me all these questions and they're shoving the, and I'm like, no, I've got to be true to the character. I'm Michael Myers.
Right.
You know, 2-3 times trying to say, who are you? Right. And I just kind of cocked my head like incredulously, like, come on, you know who I am. There's no way you don't know who I am, and all that sort of jazz. Of course, I didn't win the gentleman that was being, you know, super funny and vocal. But it taught me something about Halloween costumes, that sometimes it's better to dress up as a clown. The idea of Halloween masks is something that was the first kind of inspiration of everything. And I remember clearly walking downtown Toronto as a kid, walking into a head shop and seeing a wall of masks, you know.
Wow.
Like just John Post, Be Something, you know, just the wall of masks, just being enamored. Like, oh my goodness, look at all these different things, and all of it being extremely expensive and out of my reality. We were of a low-income family, and, you know, the best that my father could do is grease paint, and if I was lucky, we could get like a Vancouver or a Collegeville, you know, vacuum form. That really stuck with me. And then we moved a few years later. This is one of those things where, you know, again, when you look at life and you go 2020 hindsight, Salt Lake City and meeting you is definitely one of those moments as well. Of like meant to be, was supposed to happen sort of thing. But we moved and my next door neighbor literally used to dabble in special effects. He had, unfortunately he's long passed, but you know, I used to ride my bike up and down the street, and in his garage, he had a little shop. And every once in a while during the summer, his garage door would be open and I could see him either sculpting something or molding something, but in the back wall, masks. Eventually, I started stopping my bike right at, you know, the entrance to his driveway and just watch him. Mm-hmm. And this went on a couple of days. And then eventually, he just kind of waved over in his own mirror. And he said, you know, I keep seeing you watching me work. You know, you can come hang out and watch. And I started asking a bunch of questions. And I was gifted like a little mason jar with just some raw materials like casting latex and cotton balls. And he showed me how to do like cotton and latex stipple appliances. And that kind of started it.
How old were you at this point, Cesar?
10 to 11.
Okay. 10 to 11. Okay.
Yeah. Those early, early days. And then he taught me, you know, how to mix paint. And we're talking really, really basic stuff. But the most important thing that I got out of that was, one, the idea of creativity, of making something with nothing. That was the first part. And then the second part was names. So it was the first introduction to Malabar, which was a costume shop, a makeup costume shop here in Toronto. H.R. Hiscott's, which was another place that sold like wigs and that sort of stuff. And he told me that if I had an interest in makeup effects, that back in the day, there used to be local. So if I'm sure you've all seen like Wayne's World, right?
Mm-hmm.
That idea of local cable access shows and television stations that were neighborhood based was something very common here in Ontario. And I'm sure in the United States as well. But from our standpoint, it meant that there was a community, a place that you could go and they would actually train you. They would teach you how to work with a camera. They would teach you makeup. They would teach you. And that information I got from him. So that started this whole idea of going, you know, so there was a cable access at Channel 10 here that wasn't too far from my house. It was a bike ride away that I could go to and kind of bug them. And I do think it was a specific period of time where I don't know if the world was more innocent, but the doors were readily open to anybody that wanted to learn this stuff. I really had the benefit of all of that because I started learning from there. And then from there, I started talking to more people. Hey, you know, every year there's these telethons that they do for 24 hours, and they're always looking for volunteers. And so that's a good way to network. And so I started calling City TV locally. Channel 7 had one. CFTO TV Channel 9 had one. And so I started calling and saying, hey, I would like to volunteer. You know, I was a kid. And at no point did they say, but you're a kid to me. I think nowadays, if a child called up, chances are, you know, I'm sure there's laws that prevent children from working, you know, 24 hours. I was always welcomed, and I got to do everything. They taught me how to, you know, set up a shot and with a camera and how to point and focus. And I did that. Everything. My first makeup effects booklet that I got was from CFDO TV, where they taught how to do stage makeup for television. It was my first introduction to celebrities. So these celebrities, you know, Barney Miller and all of these actors that would come and that were in town and whatnot. And I had a level of exposure to them. One of them was, boy, and I can't remember his name, but it was the gentleman that played Doc on Fraggle Rock. The older gentleman that with the dog, with Sprocket. I remember going up to him and saying, listen, I have this huge interest in makeup effects, and I've been doing this, and I don't know why, but I don't think anybody ever told me about a portfolio. But I always used to walk around with like my old like instant Polaroids and pictures. I had like a little book that I would take with me everywhere. And I showed him, and he was like, oh, that's really great. And he gave me the number of the production company, and he said, you should call them and see if they'll allow you to come visit the set. And I did, and they did. And so it's just a series of really incredible events that all kind of happened. But I think the overwhelming thing out of everything for me is that even though one thing led to the other, all of them happened because there was a consistency of action. I was proactive within my life and following leads one after the other, and that kind of opened the doors. I didn't have nepotism in my life. I didn't have people that worked in the industry. I didn't know anyone. It was just one of those things where I knew I wanted to work in there. I knew I wanted to be part of the fantastic nature of it. And I just went after it as hard as I could. And yeah, and as they say, you know, the rest is history.
No, that's fantastic, that the whole thing with the neighborhood cable access.
Yeah.
The fact that you were so young and they embraced you, like, you're absolutely right. I don't see that happening nowadays. But you also had your sights on what you wanted, and you never gave up, and you continued to work towards that goal.
For sure. And I've, as a father of three, I always tell them the same story, that at the end of the day, dreams are nothing but a roadmap to your success. If you understand that, if you understand that that is what dreams are, to me, there's two types of dreams. There's the type of dream that you do when you're sleeping, and there's the type of dream that you do while you're awake. One of them is a fantasy, but the other one is a reality. And if you treat your dreams as a roadmap to your success, that means that you're proactive, that you're actively working towards that, then you will achieve it and more. I think one of the issues that most people have when it comes to dreams is that they focus too much on the final outcome. Like, oh, I want this at the end. If they do happen to achieve that thing at the end, quite often enough, that thing at the end that they so coveted, so wanted, is empty. And I have found that in my life, if I just choose to be present in the moment and enjoy the moment and enjoy the people that I'm taking the ride with and enjoy the heartache, the hard parts, the difficult things, those are the things that you ultimately remember as the great moments in your life. It's nice to know where you want to go, but don't be so rigid within it that it doesn't allow you to enjoy the process. Because the process, for me, that is life. That is the good part.
You know, Cesar, I've got to say that I fall into that trap, and I have several times. And I don't know if it's because of our age that we finally like wake up and it's enjoy the journey, not the destination.
100%.
And I totally agree with you 1,000%. And I look back at my life, at my 51 years, and how many times did I worry about the end game and not what I'm learning and not the day-to-day what experiences I'm having. And it's
well,
sad.
I mean, just reflect back on our conversations just over the past year. There are stages that you go through life, right? And when you're a child, you're enamored with becoming an adult. Time seems to stand still and take forever, and you can't wait until you're 13, and then you can't wait until you're 16 or 15, mm-hmm. and then you can't wait until you're 18 or 21, and because somehow those dates are going to allow you to become a whole person, that you're not a whole person until then, because somebody has, you know, control of your life. And then you get your control of your life and your freedom, and you tend to waste your 20s, right? You tend to Your 20s are you run around and you get drunk and you be really silly and you make major mistakes, which is a whole other thing, by the way, you know, that we have socially have made it so impossible for people to make mistakes in life right now is so troubling to me. The whole point of moving forward is making mistakes. The actual mm-hmm. definition of learning is failure. You must fail in order to learn. So this idea that somehow you can learn without failing is an absurdity to me. And we hold ourselves to measures so high that it makes us impossible to be human beings anymore. Anyhow, I digress. Let me get back to the thought.
No worries.
The end goal of everything that we do, everything that we strive for in our lives at the end of the day, is to somehow hit something that is supposed to complete us and make us better. But they rarely do. There's rarely something right. that happens that all of a sudden it's like, you know, I know I've come across people of all walks of life. Some people that are like many times over, I won't say how many Oscars because then you'll know who they are, but many time over, you know, Oscar award winners. And I've met people that are billionaires. I've met people that are, and it's amazing that when you get to know them and you're talking to them in private and one-on-one situations, and they reflect upon life and they reflect upon the thing, we're all the same. There's no different. We all wake up. We all have to evacuate. We all put pants on or skirts or whatever. We're all consistently the same. But at the core of everything is we just want to be accepted and loved, to have a sensation that our life means something when it's all said and done, that you lived the life as best you could, and that, you know, somehow you'll be remembered because mm-hmm. our paths, our lives. When we're young, everything's new. Everything's fresh. Everything's grand. So it's a bunch of firsts. Your first love, your first heartbreak, your first car, your first apartment, there's all these firsts. And then life continues and goes on, and you have less of those first experiences. They all become, oh, ho-hum, this is what life is supposed to be, really? Mm-hmm. And then, so you go from essentially gaining to a period in your life where you're losing. You're losing your mobility. You're losing your health. You're losing your hair. You're losing friends. Death becomes more apparent to you. The path ahead in terms of how many days do I have left on this becomes apparent because those people that you used to look upon, they're no longer here. It's an interesting thing because as you get older, you become more reflective and then you realize how much time you've wasted. So there's this saying, right, that youth is wasted on the youth. Really, at the heart, that's what it means, is that when you're younger, because you're having all these first experiences, you're generally not present in the moment. And then you end up spending your life in a reflective mode, looking back of like, those were my yesteryears. Those were the best of my days. And you're constantly trying to capture those. Hence, you get midlife crisis and all that sort of jazz. But
can I say one thing?
You can say as many as you want.
What you're describing, and of course, you and I think a lot alike in terms of movies, film, and media experiences that we've lived through in our lives. As you're talking about what you just said, it hit a nerve with me. Because it reminds me of the Twilight Zone movie and Kick the Can. All the old people reminiscing. You know, you take for granted all these experiences in life in your youth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look back and all of a sudden, like the people ahead of us, the people we looked up to, they're gone. And, you know, you're getting old and you see your own mortality. It was very sad. And the first time I saw that Twilight Zone movie with Kick the Can, even younger, it had an impact on me. And I watch it now and I understand that particular scene from the movie so much more. I like to revisit that film like every year or so.
The one thing that I found in terms of that I'm enjoying now. So when you don't work in the film industry, you don't know the tricks. You don't know. It's like a magic act, right? When you're, you're a magician, you know how the magic's done. So it's not as enamoring to you, you know, because of that knowledge set. So the more you work in film, the more you watch films as a technician. Why did they use that lens choice? Why didn't they do this? Why didn't, you know, and it's a bit of an unfortunate thing because the love that made me want to work in this industry has given me a knowledge that also allows me to be so very critical of it. But it also allows me, like, I'm not a huge fan of just knocking a movie. There's a very knee-jerk reaction that happens in general right now in terms of armchair critics. Oh, that movie sucked. It was horrible. Da, 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 da. I look at it from the standpoint of how long did they have? What were the conditions that they were under? What was their budget? All of those things. And then it's like, oh my goodness, you know, the thing that they were able to put on screen was really amazing. Now, story is a different thing. Story, whether or not the story is good, or that's the one part that I think we can, that I give more leeway to towards. I don't understand how this got made. Because there should be a common sense factor. The end product, I'm always more cognizant of the challenges that went into producing that thing. I digress. The thing about revisiting films is something that I've found myself doing over and over again. Movies that hit me in the one way that I thought were amazing take on different meanings as I get older.
Yeah, absolutely.
Total subtext. That I missed the first time, that now that I'm older, I go, oh my goodness, I didn't even realize that was part of the narrative that they were introducing here. This one's a little bit on the nose, but batteries not included. If you go and you watch that movie, it has a very different tone to me now in my 50s than it did when I watched it originally. Very, very different film. Cocoon. Very different film for me.
You read my mind. Because you said batteries not included, and I was going to say Cocoon, and you said it. Crazy.
Those are interesting movies to revisit throughout your lifetime as you get older. You know, John Carpenter's The Thing. That's a movie that has a very different tonal value for me now as I'm older than it did when I was younger, where I was really enamored with the monsters and the work that was in it. There is a social dynamic that is incredibly present. John's an interesting director because his work seems to be timeless. He seems to have captured something way ahead of the curve. He seemed to understand, you know, if you think about our current political and social dynamic of our world, and you go and you watch his older films, and there is, I mean, They Live. I mean,
absolutely.
It's absolutely incredible how on the nose he was with a lot of his social commentary and the dystopian future of the future.
I know we could talk all day, and we usually do, Cesar. Every time we have a
Let's
five
get back to how we met.
Right back to this is so true though, because Cesar and I will get on a conversation like, "Hey, can you give me a call for 5 minutes?" And, you know, 7 hours later, maybe all we got to do is talk about something like Jaws. And it's like, oh, my God, here we go. Yeah. So we met through the mutual friend. Again, it was because I was going to do this book. Somebody with a lot more money and connections in Los Angeles ended up doing the book. And his name is Peter Brock. And he did a great job. Yeah. And he could do it a lot faster and had more financial resources than I did. And I was able to get a bunch of interviews, and I had done one interview with one particular actress. When I had talked to her, she's like, "Oh, you're doing a book too." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she's like, "Well, this other guy, Peter, is doing this book, and you know, he's reached out to me." And at that point, I found out through some other sources that this other person with a lot of money was doing this book, and I would not be able to keep up. You know, I had to do a full-time job at the prison. So Peter produced a book that was great, and other people have said, well, isn't there room for two? But he was way ahead in the game, and so that was that. At the same time, we started to go through our roller coaster of experiences, mm-hmm. Cesar, and you know, you taught me a lot. I mean, I know that it's the first time actually working on practical effects or watching you work and doing your sculpting and then molds and everything else that you did. It was the first time being there and watching somebody create a monster and or monsters or whatever gags were needed for, you know, the things that we were writing at that time period.
So again, kind of backtrack a little bit. I mean, one of the reasons I had accepted a position in Salt Lake City was that I felt, okay, I'm not going to Hollywood, not going back to LA, I'm not going to be in Toronto, I'm not going to go to Vancouver. These are all hotbeds for productions. And so, yeah, I'll go to Salt Lake City. That's about as far away for productions, right? Mm-hmm. Well, by week two of me being in Salt Lake City, I discovered that it was the hotbed for all of Disney Channel's family films, all of those kid movies, mm-hmm. You know, television films were being done there. And I had no idea that there were so many productions, you know, that were being created. You know, one thing led to another. And then I discovered that two of my makeup effects friends were also in town locally. And so I reconnected with them. And to be honest with you, I'm not really remember how. I think the Bigfoot thing came about because you mentioned, I have this vague, your memory is much better than mine, but I have this vague recollection of us talking about the $6 million man and Andre the Giant and his portrayal of the Sasquatch on that show.
I need to tell our audience, this is a spoiler alert if you did not know this, but in the $6 million man, anybody that remembers that show, there was an episode where he battles Bigfoot, and that Bigfoot was actually portrayed by the professional wrestler Andre the Giant. I don't know how many people know that, because I don't think I really knew it until I met you. I knew that there was that episode, and I remember there's an action figure that Mattel made of that character. I didn't know it was Andre the Giant.
I think Andre really portrayed it only in one or two episodes, and then there was another actor that took over the role. But really, the one that really stuck with me was Andre the Giant. I absolutely found it terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
That the Sasquatch Bigfoot lore really became a giant thing. And in the 70s, there was also a pretty large movement of the whole mythological creature thing with the Loch Ness Monster. There was a lot of books and whatnot on the subject matter.
In search of.
Yeah, and the Robert Patterson stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, Patty, the famous Bigfoot thing. Anyhow, as per usual, it was a subject matter that we both seemed to be inclined to discuss. And you had mentioned that you were writing a story, a film, and I had started writing something as well. I think, if I remember correctly, we really didn't move forward on that particular train of thought. 13 came about. And 13 came about because of Rocky Point Haunted.
Rocky Point Haunted House.
Haunted House.
33rd South, 35th South, yeah.
There you go. One of my friends was the makeup effects guy there. You know, I got to hang out and tour the set and was really blown away by the quality of the sets that they had there. And I remember talking to the owner and saying, my goodness, is this standing all year round? And she mentioned that it was. They didn't strike the sets that it was there. And I said, so you're only open for essentially 3 months out of the year, and the rest of it is just sitting here empty? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, I would love to shoot something here. That's great. What do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. And I remember reaching out to you and saying, hey, let's write something. And I think we wrote 13 in 10 days, something like that. It was absurdly quick that we wrote that screenplay. Before I knew it, we had it cast and we had everything that we needed. Spoiler alert, it never did get made. And there's a bunch of reasons for why that happened. Suffice it to say, that really started the experience of you and I working together as co-writers in projects. it really did cement the Bigfoot thing. And for the longest time, I think the story really was like something where you had your own thing, I had my own thing, and then we had this third thing that we kind of collaborated on. As we would work on it, I started designing in clay, sculpting the creature, and through a friend, I found this Aaron. It was 17-year-old, 6'11" basketball player, was super gung-ho and wanted to be a part of it. And his parents gave their blessing, and he would come in, and we built the full bodysuit for him and turned him into Bigfoot, did a whole animatronic head, and we did some castings. We wrote a part for Don Shanks, who was Michael Myers in part 5. We did some castings of Don, and yeah, I mean, it was a really great experience, and another one that ended really badly, where
it seemed like there was months where you didn't sleep because you were, and for people to understand how much work Cesar puts into this project when he gets into his special effects, it is unbelievable, and you can see that he is an expert in this craft, and he is meticulous. He seems like he's never happy with his own work. No, you really are. You have definitely been trained by the best, Cesar, because first of all, you had that bodysuit with different muscle groups. Each muscle group is covered in fabric, so when it moves under the suit, under the fur, you can see it moving like our muscles move. And you designed this suit, and to watch you create it, and I know your wife, Marcia, she was helping along the whole process as well. Yeah. And, you know, he's doing the bodysuit, and then he's got all this fur to cover the actor. But then you got the animatronics, because the head sat on top of the actor to give several more inches to the height of this kid that's already huge.
In the suit, he ended up being 7'6".
Yeah. The eyes are done by remote control, and then like the lips move and the jaws. It was amazing to see this thing come together. I sat back and did whatever errands I could do, but of course you were the master. You were the one that knew what you were doing, and it was crazy to watch you create this monster.
I appreciate that. It was, I think it was one of those things where, again, perfect time, right? Where I had been away from it for a while and I felt energized by it. And I felt energized enough to be able to work a full-time job, which I was, and then come home and put in a second shift. No days off on the weekends. And we did that for months to kind of put this whole thing together. And really, it was just, that's the one that when I reflect back upon and I think about the one that got away, that's the one that still hurts the most, I have to say, because we had everything. Everything was ready to go. It was just one of those situations where the people that I had trusted in the finance side dropped the ball. It put me in a very precarious situation. We did try to, this was like pre all the Kickstarters that you can do nowadays and all that sort of stuff. We tried to save it, and we tried to save it at the last minute, but it didn't happen. It's always what could have been. We would have been the first one to kind of put out nobody was doing Bigfoot projects. There's been a slew of them since then, but nobody was doing Bigfoot projects. And I think we were at the right time. We had a great cast.
Do you remember like one of the meetings that you had brought in Todd Bridges for the meeting? You had been working all night on the suit and you needed to take a nap. And you're like, hey, Mark, can you go pick up Todd at the airport? So
Todd Bridges of Different Strokes.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And so I went out to the airport and I pick up Todd and give Cesar some time to take a nap. So we went to the Olive Garden and had lunch to give you time to sleep. And I got to, you know, spend a little time with Todd, and he's an interesting guy. Then we finally got together with you after you had a chance to rest and catch up. It was just a crazy period, but people don't realize that the film industry it can be very successful, but it's also very, very exhausting. There's so many moving parts.
100%. But again, even with that ill-fated final, that it came, I kid you not, a period of depression afterwards of realizing the months and months that we had put into this and it not having it come to fruition at the end. We had the whole thing cast up, And for months, I had actors reaching out to me saying, what's going on? It really did put me, you know, unfortunately, Ted White has recently passed. But one of the lovely things, I remember when everything went south, that Ted reached out to you, because Ted White was also involved in this.
Yeah, he was. And for people that don't know who Ted White is, he played Jason in Friday the 13th Part 4. But he also, it was the last living stunt double for John Wayne. And
Errol Flynn.
Oh, yeah. And I think that his first film was Hercules Meets the Three Stooges. But he'd been in the industry forever, and he was going to be part of this project as well.
Yeah. He was so kind. I remember him, him reaching out to you when everything went south, because I was so concerned. And him saying, no, please, you know, send me his address. I want to send him a note. And he sent me this lovely picture of him as Jason, basically saying, you know, keep going. It was really lovely. Like everything, for the most part, everybody understood how much out of my control that scenario was. And it still hurts. It's still one of those things that I reflect. And I still have that animatronic in a box. I'm sure the skin is long gone. At least the mechanics of that is somewhere. The suit, unfortunately, I was in storage, and I think some mice ended up nesting in it. We just couldn't save it, so we ended up tossing the suit.
Yeah. You know, you've had a very, very successful career, and you've done practical effects. Of course, you've gotten into the computer aspect of the CGI stuff. For people that are listening, can you talk about some of the projects that you've worked on in such a lengthy career? I'm sure there was some that were satisfying, some that were not as satisfying, but is there certain films that you go to when you talk about your work?
I've been blessed. There's no question about it. I mean, the reason we ended up leaving Salt Lake City was because of 9/11. It caused a ripple effect in the industry where a lot of, like I said, I was working in video games. A lot of the video game companies that are service providers, they're third parties that are hired by like Sega and Microsoft, et cetera, those contracts got pulled. And so we were one of the companies that got hit by that, living in the U.S. under a visa. And so the visa stipulated that I had to return back home. Came back to Toronto, and I found myself in a position, a very weird position, where I had closed my studio, and I ultimately ended up getting rescued by Steve Spaz Williams, who ultimately gave me my designing career in the post, you know, CG world on this film called The Wild. And that really opened the doors and kind of started things again. So I was back on film, but now I was no longer in pre-production / on set. I was now in post-production, the afterward. I really can't say that I've held all of the positions that I can in the generation of television or film content. So it started a new kind of chapter in my life, and that chapter has been a slow incremental burn over the years. But some of the things that I've been responsible for is I supervised Journey to the Center of the Earth, which I'm very proud of that particular thing, because it was the first movie that had a stereoscopic or a 3D dinosaur. That was a lot of fun to work on. I also supervised 300, which was really interesting when I went to Greece for the first time and people found out that I had worked. I was the supervisor of that, and I should say that when I say supervision, it was for the effect shots that we were working with. That kind of opened up quite a few doors. Most recently, about for the last 8 years, I've taken on different challenges. I created the creature department at a company called Spin VFX, where, you know, some of the big projects that were very instrumental, and the primary house on was the television series The Expanse, Umbrella Academy, a lot of Mike's work, so The Haunting of Hill House and Midnight Mass and all of those shows, Stranger Things.
I'm looking at your credits on IMDb, and I would suggest anybody that's hearing this podcast to go look up Cesar Decal Jr. on IMDb, Internet Movie Database. Very impressive list of credits. Firestarter, Umbrella Academy, The Man from Toronto, What We Do in the Shadows, Cabinet of Curiosities, Avatar, The Last Airbender, Raised by Wolves, Upside Down Magic, Siren, Altered Carbon, Eli, Zombieland, Double Tap, Raising Dion. A lot of these are series with multiple credits on different episodes.
Yeah.
It's crazy. You have done a lot.
Again, Mark, I am absolutely blessed. I've been put in scenarios that, and by people that have really championed my work, and I've been allowed to succeed because of that. And when I say that, I mean that there's really two ways that you can approach any kind of work. One of them is with an iron fist, where you are somewhat of a dictator and know we're going to do this and it's the only way. And I would probably say that in my 20s, that was my go-to, because the old Hollywood way was that, and that's what I was exposed to. As I got older and I became more calmer and more level-headed, I've realized that it's not conducive to creating good art. Putting people in a state of fear, it doesn't make the process any better. It doesn't make it go faster. It just introduces stress. I would say the last decade has really been about, like I said, allowing people to, different topic, but still allowing people to fail. Mm-hmm. If you allow people to fail, then you're going to get the best out of them, because there's no fear of trying something new. What we do in the post world is really all about new. It's about how do you create some new crazy thing that's never been seen before. And to do that, you need to have that mindset. One of the crazy things that I find in my life at this moment is that the people that I used to look up to, I now call friends, right? The people that I used to read about in magazines and all that. These are people that I know, and you know, some of them I know very intimately, like we talk to regularly and whatnot. And it's quite fascinating to hear them speak about, you know, the projects that, you know, that I was like flipping through and being so in love with. And it's like, man, if I had been born a decade earlier, I would have been able to work on that. But then I reflect on that as well. And I think, man, if I had, would I have worked on that? You know, because mm-hmm. I don't know whether I would have been enamored. It's an interesting thing. You know, at the one time you do lament the fact that you were just a little bit too young to be able to have crossed those paths. But at the same time, I am a firm believer, like I said, on the 2020, when I reflect back upon life, upon meeting you, everything happens for a reason.
This is usually the point in the podcast where I say, what are things that you want to accomplish moving forward from this point in your life? You've done so much as an artist, wearing multiple hats, being on set, being behind the scenes post-production. Where do you want to be moving forward? What is next for Cesar?
Mark, I think the one thing for me, I've held so many different hats. It wasn't until about 5 years ago that I was talking to my buddy Dave. Dave said something to me that made my life crystal clear, even though it was right there in front of me the whole time. Like I said, I've worked in front of the camera, I've acted, I've worked behind the camera, I've had every hat on, and I'm a storyteller. And it wasn't until Dave said to me, "You're a storyteller," that my entire life came into focus, and I realized, my goodness, that's what I am. And the one position that allows me to be a storyteller is essentially being a director. There was some ambition in the past, but it wasn't clear as to why I wanted to do that. It felt like it was a natural extension of my process. It became clear that, yeah, that's why I did all these things. That's why I learned all these things. That's why I wore all these hats. It started a chain reaction within my life of, okay, you're getting older. What do you want to do? Are you going to remain doing what you're doing for the next 20 years? There is this test that you can do that I suggest everyone does this. And this was also something that was taught to me. However morbid this is, it is absolutely valid. If you put yourself at the moment of your death, and you imagine that the Reaper has come for you, you are going to negotiate with the Reaper. What are you negotiating for? I find that the majority of people that I talk to about this thing, they always say, time. I'd like another 5 minutes. I'd like another 10 minutes. And what's interesting about that is that we tend to spend our lives saying we don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time for this. I don't have time for that. But yet we all have time to watch, binge watch 8 episodes of a show. Or we all have time to watch a movie or to play video games or to whatever it is, whatever the vice, or to scroll through Facebook. We all have those times until you're put into a situation where that time is no longer yours. You can't get back. You start to reflect like the value of time. Where do I want to spend it? So my time now is really spent living my life as best I can, trying to put one foot in front of the other, waking up, working on projects that I want to work on. I have stories that I've written that I want to tell, including Beyond the Myth, where I would like to return. That was the Bigfoot movie. And so my goal is to make movies for me, not for an audience, make movies that I want to make. And hopefully those movies find the audience that they're meant for. I've been involved with so many projects now where you curtail to the masses, you curtail to the numbers, you curtail the story to what you think will be the popular zeitgeist of the moment. It always waters down the project and it makes it not quite what its original intent was. I want to make movies that ultimately satisfy me. And I know that sounds very singular and very selfish, but I don't know how you can make art and in it not be about you. If you try to make art for the masses to please everyone, in the end, you'll please no one. So you have to make it for you first.
I also look at the perspective of you working for so many other creators doing what their vision was, and there's limitations to what you can do. And I think that you're absolutely correct, 100%. You are capable of so much. And I think that it's great for you to create your own work from start to finish. It's something you need to do.
One thing that we're going to be doing that I'm excited for is about a decade ago, we went through a rather dark period with some health issues with my daughter. Coming out of that period when she started to rebound from her health, become healthy again, one of the things that I found was I was having a very hard time becoming creative again, finding my creative juices. And so various friends kind of helped me along the way. And one of the things that came out of that was these YouTube videos. We did this thing called Monster Month. And every single day, I would wake up early in the morning, create an armature, and slap play on that. And wherever I got at the end of the day is where I got. These weren't finished, polished sculptures. They were just blocking things in. Trying to, one, get me going again and feeling like working. But two, also hopefully inspire people to try it themselves. So we did that. And by the end of that process, we were getting a lot of emails, messages sent to us, and it made us very excited about the prospect of like continuing the channel. And in fact, if you do go and watch the videos, you'll see that at the end, we kind of discussed that we had some plans and that we wanted to do some further things. But ultimately, it didn't progress forward because it just wasn't a reality. You know, once I started working again, the full-time job plus the tasking of creating all of this content just was too much. There was just no way we could do it. So it remained dormant. But the channel has been there. It's been going for the past 10 years or so. And we still get messages almost on a daily basis asking, whether I'm alive. Thankfully, I am. what we had done at the time kind of spurred on a bunch of innovation. And there's a bunch of channels now on YouTube that do very similar things. And it's wonderful.
Can I just say this real quick, Cesar, for people that are listening? If you go into YouTube, you would just search for Cesar DeCall Jr., just JR, and you'll see the picture. It's actually Cesar's picture, and you can see the videos. You got 32.8 thousand subscribers. Yeah, you've got a following, but you can see how you create these monsters. And it's everything from like the tools to different particular demons, armatures. It's fascinating. If you have any interest in special effects, I implore you to go to this channel and check out Cesar. How long does each one of these videos run?
They're relatively short. I think they're maybe 15 minutes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, they're not very long videos. The reason I bring up the channel is because we are revamping it. We're bringing it back. We're bringing the channel back. It became, again, if I can jump a few years, quite a few years ahead, I was sculpting a critter for my daughter, Grace, as a birthday present. And again, my buddy Dave, the same one that kind of told me I was a storyteller, suggested I do some Facebook Lives. I had no idea what that was, but discovered what it was and started to do that. And again, did that over the course of 2.5 weeks while I was building that crate. That got the idea going of, hey, maybe I can use this as a way for me to communicate and continue to teach. The one thing that I've learned is that I enjoy teaching quite a bit. I enjoy seeing the fruits of somebody's labor, of somebody, not knowing how to do something, picking it up and then turning it around and putting something out they never imagined was possible. So we're going to be doing that. I'm actually sitting in, I'm talking to you from a small studio space that we've rented. We're on the final kind of leg here of organizing and preparing this, and we will be going live with these sessions. So I, if it's something that interests you, I just search again, Cesar DeCall Jr. on both Instagram and on Facebook and on YouTube, and we will be posting much more about that in the coming days and weeks.
When this episode of the podcast goes live, I'll definitely put the link for your YouTube page on all of the social media for the podcast so people can check it out and see what you do, because you are very talented. It's amazing. I'm not watching any of the videos because I'm listening to you, but I'm just seeing the screen grabs of the different videos that you've got posted. It's awesome stuff.
Well, thank you, Mark. You've always been a good champion of me. And I do want to say one thing that you mentioned about me never being happy. That is the bane of, I think, every artist's existence. So one thing that it's inevitable when it comes to learning. I've learned to love everything that I've done, but understand that, of course, by the time I get to the end of it, I know I can.
That sounds terrible. That sounds so frustrating. Oh my God.
But that's the nature of learning, right? Like every time you're learning how to do it better and better and better. Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely a challenge.
Do you think that Steven Spielberg looks at Jaws and says, oh, I should have done this, or I could have done
for sure. For sure.
That's terrible.
A lot of actors, they will not look at themselves because it's the self-critical nature of like, oh, why did I make that choice? I should have done this or should have done that. 100%. Every artist that I know, every single person that I know, I remember talking to Joe Dante once about The Explorers. And I was saying, oh my God, I love The Explorers. And he basically said, I hate The Explorers. I hate that movie. It's the worst movie I've ever done. And I was like, are you kidding me? He's like, oh no, that ending of that movie is, there was budgetary, I had one vision, there was going to be a baseball game, and we were going to be doing this, and we were going to do that, and I couldn't do it. And I told him, I said, Joe, you're being far too harsh on yourself.
Cesar, we've talked about a lot of philosophy, which I really didn't know we were going to be going down this path today, but I really enjoyed listening to you and talk about the experiences and your knowledge in this industry. but I have to, before we close out this episode, I've got to talk about an experience that we had at a grocery store.
Oh, boy.
See, but you're already laughing. So, you know, I'm a practical joker, and anybody that knows me knows I'm a joker.
You have to preface this that in Utah, there are no lotteries.
I will definitely lead into it. I love those, and a lot of people are already going to, like, they're going to frown because they think that this is mean. Anybody that knows anything about practical jokes or magic stores where they sell practical jokes, it's very easy to find these scratch tickets, these lotto tickets that are duds. They're jokes, but they're set up and they look pretty authentic. And you scratch them and you can get them as winners, and they could be $5,000, $25,000, $100,000. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been known in certain jobs that I've had when I used to take out inmates on work cleanup, work detail, and we're going down the road, and these guys are picking up bottles and trash and whatever they find just to clean up the public roads. Knowing that these guys are incarcerated, I'll take a scratch ticket and I'll throw it out on the ground when they're not looking, and then they think they stumbled upon it. So, and I've done this numerous times. It's always fun. But I had this one particular guy, and he found the ticket, and I'm watching him out of the corner of my eye. He doesn't want me to know because they can't pick up tickets. They can't claim the prizes. So he scratches the thing, and it's a $10,000 winner. And he runs over to the truck. And I'm sitting in the driver's seat of the truck, and he goes, DeWolf, you're not going to believe it. I just won $10,000. I can finally get my teeth fixed. That's really fucked up of me. And I know that. And I had to tell him, you know, because he's really excited. He's gone years without any teeth in the front of his head. And I said, now, look, I got to tell you something right now. I said, you'll always be a winner in my book, but that ticket isn't worth shit. He told me, he said, you're a real motherfucker. You know that? And when he connected the dots, he realized it was a setup. But when I did it to the next guy, and this guy is still working with me in the truck, when I did it to the next guy, do you think that he wasn't fucking totally excited? He couldn't wait to see how it played out. But it wasn't done to be mean. So basically, that's how those tickets work. Now, when you go to Utah and there is no lotto, that's gambling and it's not allowed. You have to go to Nevada, the next state over, or you have to go up to Idaho to get scratch tickets or the big lotto tickets. Mm-hmm. Cesar and I were at the grocery store buying dinner one night, and I think you were there for a visit, right? You were visiting Utah?
Yeah, I was just visiting, yeah.
Okay. And so I looked in my wallet. I'm going up to pay at the grocery, at the clerk, and I look and I'm like, oh, fuck, I can get Cesar. I've got one of those tickets. Cesar's just in front of me, and I said, hey, man, I've got one of these scratch tickets, and I never win. I've bought several of them. Maybe you got some luck. Maybe Lady Luck will bless you. And I hand it to him, and he's like, no, I don't play those. And he hands them back, and I'm like, oh, fuck. No, seriously, just go ahead and give it a try. And we're doing this back and forth. And Cesar's like, well, you know what? Let's just give it to her. And he hands it to the clerk, the cashier. Now, you can imagine I just lost control of my fucking practical joke. And there's a pucker factor of, oh, fuck. And the cashier, like, takes it, and she's a good Mormon girl. She's never even seen one of these. Well, what is this? And then Cesar, being the nice guy he is, he jumps right into explaining, all you do is you scratch it, and if there's three matching dollar amounts, then you win that dollar amount. You can imagine Cesar is leaning over while beads of sweat are flying out of my fucking forehead, because I'm like, oh shit. Cesar is leaning over watching, and she's this poor innocent bystander. She's scratching and she's looking at it, and Cesar, I'll never forget Cesar, he goes, are you kidding me? Because you just gave away a $50,000 winner. So the girl's looking at it, trying to process that she now won't have to work this part-time job for years. And so I'm like, I got to tell Cesar, like, now. Like, Cesar, that's a gag ticket. And you instantly knew what it was. And so you start laughing, and you lean over. You're like, oh, can I see that? And she pulls it into her chest, and she steps back like, oh, fuck you. No way, I'm not going to give this up now. And reaction. I think that was the best part because she instantly thought you were going to try to get it back. And yeah. She's like, oh, fuck, no, I'm quitting tonight. I'm telling Bob I'm out. And you were laughing so hard. I was still nervous because I felt kind of bad. The joke was supposed to be on you, and you got me because you gave it away. And I'm like, oh, fuck. So that was classic. And those are the moments that Cesar and I had all the time. We'd laugh. I mean, Cesar gets very intense. He's an artist. And when he gets into a project, man, he is so focused. I'm the fuck off prison guard. You know, I'm just trying to have fun, man. And so, I'll go along and I enjoyed the writing and stuff. But Cesar, you are an artist. And I've enjoyed so much time tonight talking about how intense you are and what a successful career you've had. I really appreciate you coming on this podcast.
Well, Mark, I love you to death, man.
And I love you.
Yeah. I mean, anytime I know you and I can just chat for hours and hours and hours. So anytime you want, you want to chat some more and talk more stories, don't hesitate. I hope that someday we're sitting on rockers, overlooking, the ocean or some beautiful sunset talking about these things. Because really, to me, that's all that matters. The memories that you make, that's what you take.
We will be in rockers and I'll be the one that put the whoopee cushion underneath you. And when you sit down and when that thing explodes, I'll look at you and I'll laugh being the gay guy. And I'll say, he's a virgin.
Just make sure it makes a high pitch.
Right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and close out this podcast. I'm going to tell everybody the same thing I tell them every week, and that is to be good. And if you can't be good at it. And if you're sitting in prison, you're not good at it. Good night, everybody.